Welcome to Book Reporter Talks To, a podcast from the Book Report Network, where we host in-depth conversations with authors about the books that we love. We know authors cannot travel everywhere, so we want to bring them to you, wherever you may be. Welcome to our latest episode of Book Reporter Talks To. Our guest today is Sharon Virts, and we are going to be talking about her latest novel, Veil of Doubt. It's a Book Reporter Betson selection, as was her last book, Mask of Honor. I thoroughly enjoyed interviewing her the last time, so I am so looking forward to this conversation. In our review of Veil of Doubt, Amy Gwazdowski had this to say about it. Virts does a great job of making you, as a reader, feel invested in the case. If you're looking for rich historical fiction to keep you company on a cool fall evening, Veil of Doubt is your book. And I completely agree. And with that intro, welcome, Sharon. It's so good to see you.
Thank you, Carolyn. Thank you for having me back again. I'm just honored to be here and to talk to your folks on your club and the folks that come to your podcast. I mean, you're just great. And you've been a wonderful friend over the years. And I'm just happy to be here. I'm just so pleased.
It's so much fun because go into the second book and going, I enjoy it as much as I did the first, and I actually liked it even more. So let's start about you giving us an overview of Veil of Doubt. Just tell people what they're going to be seeing.
Right. Okay. So Veil of Doubt is set in 1872 in a Virginia town, actually the town that I kind of grew up in, sort of this Reconstruction era right after the Civil War, 1872 timeframe. And it's about a woman who went on trial for the murder of her four children, her husband, and her aunt. But it really isn't her story. It is the story of the defense attorney who stood up for her when really no one else would and defended her in the courts here that were, at the time, almost a court of public opinion in a lot of ways. And so it's his story. It's the story of Pal Harrison and how he saw Emily Lloyd, the woman that was on trial, from his perspective and through his eyes. Mm-hmm. So in it takes you on, I think, an interesting journey of a whodunit, if you will. Mm-hmm. Yes. And you also get a chance to see the legal system as it was in 1872 in Virginia. You get to see a bit of that reconstructed South in terms of how people's emotions were and some of the descriptions in the scenes. You get a sense of what Virginia was like back then. And also, I think the forensic science in this book is, I tried to do it as much as I could in layman's terms because I am not a chemist. I had to learn all of this. And then finally, just mental health, where we were and where we weren't. I mean, Freud had not been, had not been published. I don't know if he was even born yet, but the point of it was that there was none of this sort of psychiatry as we know it today. And how women were treated when they didn't have a husband and they had no one to take up their cause in cases where they may not necessarily be, mentally capable of speaking for themselves in a way in which they're heard. So it's a book that's got a bit of all that sort of stuff in sort of thrown into it.
Yeah. Yeah. And as a result, the way it all comes together, all those different threads are what make the book so special. I'm going to start by sharing a few questions here from Amy, a reviewer. Your character, Emily Lloyd, is based on a real person who was accused of murdering her entire family in Virginia and was labeled a serial killer, like at the time where that was.
And still today, you see the stories about her. Yes.
Serial killer. How did you come across this bit of history and what made you want to write about her?
Okay. So as I think many people know, or maybe you don't know, but I am the really passionate about history. I love it. And am the president of a local museum here. And I was working on a project with the clerk of the court on digitization, how we get some of these records, digitized so that we can have access to them. And so the clerk started sending me their newsletters and sent me a bunch of back archived editions. And I was just doing reading through them to get a sense of the work the clerk office does that's not necessarily related to the court, but the retention of records and history. And I stumbled in one of these newsletters, an article about Emily Lloyd. And it's interesting. I should have known about it because they do this hauntings tour every year and she's the subject of it, but I don't really participate in it. So I just sort of oversee the activities of the museum. And so I read this article in that paper and I was like, wow, that's interesting. And this is a very small town, even smaller in 1872. And to have that go on here. So I started researching it and just sort of fell in love with the story. Not so much her so much. I mean, I was trying to figure her out. But, the front page headline news and how the whole town was engaged in it, and New York and Philadelphia and Alexandria and Richmond and all these other places were reporting on at the time. And so I thought, well, this will be a great story, you know, to sort of go after. I just was fascinated by it.
Yeah. And it's, you know,
all those years of watching CSI maybe, or Criminal Minds, you know.
Exactly. It's like from back then. You know, it's really interesting because the way you develop her, at points she's believable, at points you feel sympathy for her, and at other points you just know something's not right. And I feel like you came at developing her character in all these different ways, so that she was somebody that we really couldn't trust as what she was doing. We didn't know
why. An unreliable.
So unreliable. Did you know at the beginning that that's what you were going to do with her? Or did that come as you started writing?
So I had a really tough time, you know, with who was going to be the protagonist and really where to start the story. That, I mean, as an author, one of the toughest things for me is structure. Always has been. But once I get the structure, the outline, I know where I'm going. But I didn't know if I was going to have her as a protagonist or not. And so that's, I originally thought it was going to be. And then the more I got into her head, the more I didn't want to be there. Mm-hmm. And I said, I think the best way to tell her story is through the eyes of someone else. And so at first I thought maybe I'll make up a reporter kind of person that, you know, that sort of is telling her story. And then when I was reading some of the trial notes, at the time there were actually four attorneys that were on the case. And at the end, it's another crazy thing in Virginia law, although we don't do it today. Each attorney gave a closing argument.
Wow.
I didn't do that to you because I have. Wow. It was the Pal Harrison argument that really, really struck me. And I said, he's my guy, because he focused in on just some basic stuff. The other guys were all pontificating about a mother and couldn't harm her children. He went right to the heart of the issue. And I don't want to give away too much because I don't want to put a spoiler out here. And that's when I realized I had to tell through his eyes. And in developing her character, Emily Lloyd's character, I tried to look at her the way Pal must have looked at her. Mm-hmm. He made some pretty big decisions in this case. And he did drive. He was the lead attorney on this, even though two of the attorneys were older and more experienced than he was. It was clear he was the guy that was driving this case. And I said, how did he see her? Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of where I started. And then I took her to my friend, Julie Fender, who is a psychologist. And I presented her to her. Mm-hmm. And I said, are you thinking what I'm thinking? And she said, yeah, she's definitely got some of this, maybe some of that. And so we kind of worked together to come up with how we were going to present her mm-hmm. to all of you. Right. Which was, you know, not so much from a, you know, what she said every day, or it was just more of, you know, where her head was, you know, depression, all the trauma that she had suffered, mm-hmm. how she was protecting herself from some of that trauma, how she was maybe confused. I mean, we all know that, I know about you, but when I get upset about something, I kind of put things and people in a box and, mm-hmm. and try not to deal with it. And so, you know, maybe she's, you know, her forgetfulness and some of this is because she's just trying to protect herself. So we kind of came up with that. And so I wrote her from that perspective. But Emily Lloyd was very, very tough. Mm-hmm. Very, very tough to write. Yeah. As were, you know, some of the other characters that were affiliated with her. Very tough.
And it's also, you feel like she didn't talk a lot because of a lot of things that were going on. She was in her own head a lot. That's what I felt when I was reading the book. She lived right there a lot. The scientific aspect of the case that played out in the courtroom was fascinating. And while chemistry was quickly developing and as trusted science in 1872, there's still a lot of constraints on science at that time. So how difficult or interesting was it to learn about arsenic? Was it bismuth poisoning, especially in the 19th century? I mean, were you really good in science?
Well, first off, let me just say this, that if my husband ever drops dead of something, God help me. Because the Google search history on my computer is just awful. You know, I mean, how, the symptoms of arsenic poisoning and detection and all this other stuff, crazy. So there was some of the forensics in this particular case, some, not so much in the court case records, because there's some that's just missing, but in the newspapers. Mm-hmm. But there wasn't a lot. And so I went to another case that was similar in Baltimore, and pulled a lot of the way in which they did testing and the colors of participant and how the spots looked from another case to be able to weave it into this. So there wasn't as much of that in this particular trial as there was in this other case. And so I kind of merged those things. Mm-hmm. But I didn't, you know, the whole bismuth thing, I had to you know, Google search and then talk to Dr. Ed Puccio at the local ANOVA hospital here and get his sense on, you know, the symptoms. Could arsenic poisoning be, you know, or could the symptoms of what you saw in arsenic poisoning be, in today's world, an allergic reaction to aspirin? And so they were, maybe they were putting this, you know, some of these compounds in the mimicked aspirin in the salts themselves. Was that what she was suffering from? You know, some sort of allergic reaction that caused these symptoms to happen. So I spent a lot of time with doctors, and then in chemistry books, and then with my husband, because I don't know how it's, you know, calculating the mathematical proportions of an English grain and a French gram and teaspoons of sugar, all this stuff, you know, it took, you know, and I get confused. I'm like, wait a minute, did I do it? And so he'd go back and check my math and make sure I had it right. That's not my forte, you know, chemistry and math.
Is she killing a horse or killing a child? Like, you know, what's it going to do?
Right, right.
You know, what are we going to do?
And then on that note too, I had to change some things. So for example, because I wanted something to happen to one of the characters after, right after the cemetery, when they exhumed the bodies for a second look. And in the real world, it happened beforehand. And it impacted another piece of evidence. But so I had to switch some things around. So I stayed true to the spirit of the story, but it was not the stomach that actually was in the real case that was analyzed, but it was the things from the cemetery that they'd taken out later. But the stomach did get thrown out. But I switched those around in order for my pacing to work. And sometimes you have to do that, right?
Yeah.
And in order to get...
It's a historical mystery. It doesn't mean it has to be, you know, you're not presenting the case to court. It's like, right. This is what, you know, could have happened. You know,
but I stay true to that story though, Carol. That's the thing, you know, the spirit of it. You know, I've learned this. If you stay true to exactly whatever happened, you'll lose your audience.
Yeah, it's not going to happen. You know, what's interesting, when they were looking for evidence for the autopsy, I was shocked how they removed the organs at first. Like, they just take this thing out and walked out. Like, we'll take the stomach with us out of the house. And we'll leave in it, like in a bag, like in wrapped in fabric. And we're going to go do an autopsy. Is that what they were doing at those times?
That's exactly what they did. So in the real trial, that stomach does get thrown out of evidence because the person that took it to Baltimore had died and they couldn't prove chain of custody. I flipped that with the last bit because I had a reason for that. But the stomach, and I didn't go through the entire testimony at the original inquest because it's just too much and it was repetitive. But in that discussion, in that testimony, they cut that child's stomach out right there in front of the mother. They dragged her down the stairs. They took it out in a cloth. Blood was dripping on the floor in her house and then down the street. He tossed it onto the counter. And waited for the other guys to show up. And then in the real trial, well, in the real inquiry, they changed their tune and they changed testimony. He testified to that first, and then he changed this after a break. He came back and says, I was mistaken. I had too many headaches from, you know, those shelling during the war. I don't remember. I mean, it was insane, but that's exactly what they did. Right there in front of the mother, right there in her parlor.
Yeah. Crazy. Yeah. This is what we think we should do. We should think...
And then the graveyard on the second one, the second autopsy, they did this, the same thing I said. They sprinkled lime or some sort of chemical all over the bodies as they were cutting them, which was obviously contaminating stuff.
Yeah.
They picked up the same knife. They threw it on the ground. They picked it up again. They used a headboard to lift these bodies out and did them right there. And people were standing around watching all this. I mean, and I go out to the cemetery and I look and see where they were. I mean, you can see the space where they were doing it. You go, oh my goodness, they truly did all that.
It's like, just take the body out. We'll cut it. Let's get a crowd going. Maybe we can take some votes. I mean,
it was insane. I mean, you know,
those were the times.
I think one of the reviews I got recently, someone said that they felt that some of this was far-fetched. And I'm going, okay.
You win.
Truth is sometimes stranger than fiction, right?
Yes, exactly. You know, I felt like Powell losing his son makes him more vested in this case as well than he might have been. So let's talk about that, because it's, he knows what that loss, his child died, and we don't have to go into all the details right now, but his child died in an accident, like a real accident of what happened. And it's not like, who's to blame? And he's sitting there like, who's to blame? And I think he's looking at this case the same way of, who's to blame here? Like, where are you going to point blame? Did she poison the child, or what? Where did something go awry just based on what happened with him? Am I on something there?
So one of the things that the whole thing about blame, and this whole discussion of Powell's faith, one of my favorite scenes, by the way, is that one scene toward the beginning when she's been incarcerated, and then he comes to her house and interviews her, mm-hmm. and he shares with her that he's lost his faith in God. Mm-hmm. And they have these moments, the two of them just talking about the great loss. And, you know, they talk about, I think the Bible verse that gets quoted to John, you know, about the cripple at the pool of Bethesda and how Christ only saved the one and left all the others. And why was it my son? Why was it my son, the one that, or my daughter in her case, the one that was saved? And this whole thing about blame, you'll know that Powell blames himself, mm-hmm. and he knows what that feels like. Mm-hmm. And he is his own judge and his own jury, and he has to learn to forgive himself, right? That he has to accept what he could not control. Mm-hmm. And that he at a moment he just, you know, didn't look up for his son, was too engaged, and his son died in this accident. And I think he looks at Emily in that same right, you know, was this an accident? You know, mm-hmm. and is she blaming herself? Is that why she's so confused? Is that why she can't remember? Is that why? Because she's trying to protect herself from herself. Mm-hmm. Because you'll notice that in one of the jail scenes, she cries and she says, oh my God, if it was in the milk, I gave it to her. Mm-hmm. Right? She's blaming herself. So he knows what that feels like. And so that's kind of that connection between the two of them. They both have lost and they both feel like they are to blame. Now, he never goes out there and says that to her, but I think that's part of the message, and particularly when he's coming with his closing arguments and he changes things, he says that,
yeah.
you know, who's to blame? They need, like I do, we all need someone to blame. I've been blaming God. It's me, mm-hmm. right? She's blaming, who's she blaming? They need, the jury's need someone to blame. So that's kind of a big part of it. Blame, faith, acceptance mm-hmm. of things you can't control.
Mm-hmm.
All yeah. themes that undermine this book, or underpinnings of this book.
Yeah, and you think about a trial, it's always like, who's to blame? It's always in the trial, who's to blame for what happened? And it's going to come up there. It's like, who's guilty, who's to blame? And they're two different things, guilty and blame.
Well, it's interesting. So, you know, when we talk about insanity, please, I did a lot of research on this, and I'm not a lawyer. Right? So I had lawyers make sure my arguments were correct and my objections were right. You know, he talks about insanity, please, is that it's really tough for a defense attorney. And he, you know, back then they didn't teach this. They didn't have a lot of them that were very successful. You admit up front that the person that's sitting in front of you is the one that killed these people. Right. But they're not responsible because they're not in their right mind. Mm-hmm. And therefore they are a victim. Mm-hmm. So you've got to convince the jury that the person is not guilty, even though you've told them up front that they did indeed do it, but they weren't in their right mind. Therefore they can't be held accountable, but that jury still wants someone to blame.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what, you know, he was trying to get to about how tricky these insanity cases are. And, you know, there was very few successful insanity cases, especially for men. Very right. interesting. I've always said that, you know, women are, you know, judging peers, men are not necessarily peers of women, and they have a different look at them in that time frame. But there were very, very few insanity cases that were won when there was a man on trial.
Right.
But a lot of insanity cases, you know, the police, they were found not guilty based on the fact that they were women. Mm-hmm. Women, they get hysterical. You know, you get depression, you get, you know, your menstrual cycles can have something to do with, you know, your brain.
Right.
You know, there's too much stress, you can't reproduce. I mean, it's all these things.
Right. Right.
They were kind of crazy.
Yeah. It was like really were crazy. And then you got these chapters with these two female neighbors, Laura and Lilith, that give readers a really good look at these women. One is good and Bible thumping, and the other one is fairly raunchy. I mean, I think that's the best way to sit there. And you did a really good job of setting them up for the readers. I got the feeling that those chapters, when they come in, you enjoyed writing, because it's a complete diversion from everybody else. It's good and evil in the same room.
I loved writing them. You're right. You know, I love dialogue. You know, I'm one of these people that I write in dialogue and then I fill in the bit later. I love the exchanges. And sometimes it got too raunchy and editor said, no, you got to cut that out. I actually had one editor that looked at it and said they wanted them gone altogether because they felt that they distracted from the main story. I said, oh no, you need some of this comic relief, some of this back and forth between the two of them. It just can't be too stereotypical. It's got to be, you know, or too much, you know, melodrama, but I thought they were hilarious. I loved writing Lilith. I thought she was so much fun to write.
Yes.
And I love writing that scene where Pal and JW break into their house.
Yes.
And find some of her toys.
Toys. Yes. Yes. Bedroom. Looking up, I was like, whoa, whoa, whoa. This is like,
and, you know. I researched all those and made sure those did exist in that time period. And I put the little, so when the editors went back in, I put the little references to them so they could find them, so they didn't have to question me about, you know,
were those actually happening at the time. Yeah, but it was just so funny because there was such a yin and yang of the two sisters, but it really comes into play. You know, there are also these numerous references to the Civil War. Powell has thoughts about the friend he lost. And were you talking about true characters here? Like when you're talking that, you know, that is his friend who died, and what had happened with the woman there. It was just so interesting because you bring in the after effects of the war. Like this is what happens when men go home and think about who died on the field.
Yes. So I don't know the particular person's name, but there was a captain that was in that group called Daniel Green that did die. You know, Powell, I know, was deeply affected by the war and some of his writings post the war, you could really tell. And I made the situation between Danny Green and Maggie Green. They were composite characters, if you will. Maggie is three women together. Mm-hmm. And you know, the situation with her father, et cetera, I thought was interesting because some of that was true. And Daniel Green did die at Gettysburg. He was a captain and was in Pickett's Charge. And so I wanted to capture some of that horror. Mm-hmm. And Pal Harrison did lead that wagon train back. He was, you know, the top attorney advisor to General Bowdoin as they came back 17 miles wagon train of injured soldiers into Virginia, stuck at the Potomac because of the floods at Williamsport. So I wanted to capture some of that horror that I'm sure he witnessed. Additionally, Pal was the attorney overseeing for Bowdoin the prison system in the Confederacy. Uh-huh. So you could, I mean, I had an uncle that died, and a great, great, great uncle, obviously, that died in Andersonville. And I can only imagine the horrors mm-hmm. that were witnessed, in those prisons. And so I wanted to capture some of that mm-hmm. and those feelings without taking you down into, you know, flashbacks to the war that are just horrible. Because otherwise we lose the point of this story, mm-hmm. but this area, I mean, if you think about it, it was only what, 5-6 years beforehand. It wasn't that long. Mm-hmm. 7 years. And that's not, you know, it was still pretty raw. And, you know, this area that I grew up in and where this building of this story is set is right along the Potomac here. And this was going on all the time, back and forth. You know, we call them the Yankees were over here one time and the rebels were there. I mean, constant battling back and forth in this area. So I can't imagine what it was like, not just for the soldiers, but for the people who lived in these towns.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, war's going on all around you. It's not like we picked a battlefield and we all went there. No, it's right around the towns. You know, you also referenced the war because at one point Powell's talking about it being different time than during the British War, which is a time when the country was united. And I really like this. Matt comes back saying, not so sure about that. I think we've always been divided about one thing or another. That's what democracy breeds, the freedom to express different opinions. It's what makes us Americans. And Powell responded, and what nearly destroyed us. And those are very poignant lines that can play through history.
Well, that's why I wrote them, because they apply today.
Times in history can go right through today, but it also could go through times in the 20s or the 30s. When you think about where the country has been, and it's really because we have the freedom to say something different. And I thought when I read that, I was like, he's putting the war in a box over here, but he's also saying why that box was different than the earlier box. Like it had a different meaning this time around.
But it's always the same box. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you look at the War of 1812, which, you know, in my first book, I wrote about that a bit, you know, and a lot of the reasons that we didn't really finish the Revolutionary War, you know, and we fought the War of 1812 was, again, it was a North and South issue. Right. In the War of 1812, the South didn't want to go to war against Britain, but the North did because they were doing more manufacturing and, mm-hmm. you know, their businesses and economies were being hurt, the Northern states. And remember back then, we were almost like European states. Right. You know, you had the Dutch in New York, you had the Germans in Pennsylvania, the Free State, you had all the wealthy, you know, aristocrats down here in the South. they were almost like their own little countries in some cases. So the Southern states didn't want to fight that war, but they got pushed into it when they burned Washington, et cetera. So they did. And then the Civil War was just the opposite. You know, it came to a head, right? The mm-hmm. North didn't want the use of enslaved labor, whereas the South did. And at the time, the South was unbelievably wealthy compared to the North,
yes,
because they weren't paying for labor. Mm-hmm. So it was a way to, you know, in a lot of people's minds, which is not the way it really is, but, you know, it was trying to even up the economies of these two entities. And unfortunately, you know, at the horrors of what slavery brought on to so many people, just awful, right? But the ability to have these differing opinions, these to think differently, to express your opinions, and, you know, that those disagreements mm-hmm. can divide us if we allow it. And we mm-hmm. should take lessons from what happened in the Civil War and what happened in 1828 when, you know, South Carolina wanted to secede then, and Jackson said no. And, you know, in the War of 1812 and many wars, the Vietnam War, I know you're interviewing an author soon on that.
Yeah.
Another one where we were very, very divided. And we have to understand that that's what democracy is, those freedoms. Mm-hmm. And it's been going on since we started this country. We are an experiment here.
Right.
And we have to lead by example and show that we can disagree without fighting, mm-hmm. without fighting each other, without letting it destroy us, as the Civil War nearly did.
Yeah, really did. It almost, it destroyed the country for a long time. And I think that's what Powell was saying as well, is you sat there and you looked at, you know, what really happened along the way. And Matt's trying to say to him, but this is why. And he's like, but still, let's look at what it did. It nearly destroyed us.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah.
So Powell also talks about having to become a chemist to be able to work on this trial. And
look at the author.
and the author also became a chemist. You know, I mean, there were certain things like bismuth. Is that how it's pronounced?
Bismuth. Yeah.
I did not even know what this was. And when they were describing lime water and bismuth, like, I think, boy, what do we have today? Did we outdo our resistance to lime water and bismuth somewhere along the way?
Well, it's kind of like Alka-Seltzer with a bit of Pepto-Bismol together.
Okay. All right. That's what we're dealing with. Okay.
Right. So bismuth is actually in Pepto-Bismol, but it's all done a whole different way now. It's the same sort of substance, that pink sort of thing. And I don't know if you've ever taken too much Pepto-Bismol, but your tongue gets all black.
Okay. I didn't know that.
I didn't even realize all this. I mean, like I said, that's what I talked to doctors for. They helped me with some of that.
Are you practicing? Yeah. See what happens
with my tongue. You look at, what's interesting is if you look on the periodic table, bismuth and arsenic and antimony, they're all on the same line. They're all heavy metals, all poisonous. If there's too much of it, obviously.
Yeah.
And I didn't know that either. I mean, I've been doing all kinds of research about that, but yeah, Powell needed to be a chemist. I needed to be a chemist. And a lot of the chemistry did get cut because, you know, it could go on and on and on. And I think I had one editor that said, hey, maybe you should cut more. I'm like, I don't know. I kind of want to have a little bit of that for all the CSIs and all of us. I mean, maybe not everybody's a CSI kind of person, but I really like those, you know.
But it's sort of like this edge of like, what are these things that we don't know about today? Like, okay, you could say it's a Pepto-Bismol, but we didn't. What are the, I mean, you don't look at the bottom of back of the bottle of Pepto-Bismol and go, oh, look, bismuth, oh, lime water. You know, look at those things.
So, I read a case recently, I think it was in Australia. It was like maybe 2013, where a woman drank like a bottle of Pepto-Bismol every day, like a whole bottle, and went into bismuth poisoning. And it caused, her like kind of lose her mind, you know, brain issues. And, you know, they were able to save her, obviously she lived, but there's some modern day cases of it where people were just, you know, because they have stomach upset and they just drink it and drink it and drink it. So it is poisonous if you drink too much of it.
Read the labels.
All the things I learned.
Read the labels, folks, read the labels. You know, I didn't realize until I was flipping back to do notes last night that the trial doesn't commence till more than halfway through the book. Like, there's this whole setup going on. Did you always plan a really big run up to it? Because the trial is sort of like that moment where everything's going to come together. But you've got this long run up where we're sitting there going, whoa, now we're there. Now we got to the trial.
Yeah. Well, I, you know, part of the process for me is I put together this. So when I start a story, I get a big whiteboard, and then I, you know, some people use like these, you know, note cards. I don't, I use sticky notes. And so I put a date on a sticky note or an event, or I put a timeline up, and then I'll start putting the sticky notes, you know, major events under the timeline where they go. And then you look where they're clustered and you go, okay, you know, there's a lot of stuff that was going on before the trial. And I thought, let's box it at a year, Let's start it when the last death. Let's finish it at the end of the trial, more or less. Let's just run it over a year, and then build up to that sort of trial point. Because for me, I didn't want it to be just a John Grisham courtroom drama.
Yeah.
Because I'm not an attorney, and I really was going to screw it up. And like you said, I wanted to use that trial as sort of that 75% mark where it all starts to come together. The hard part was how to string out clues as we went and lead you down different roads that wouldn't be revealed until trial. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yes.
How to tee it up.
And how to make sure
I wanted the trial to be the sort of the defining moment.
Yeah. But how to get all those threads to then come together at the trial and then go from there back out.
But when you have those sticky notes, I've got some right here. So when you have like these sticky notes, I put them on my wall or whatever. When you see them cluster, you can kind of see what you're dealing with.
Right.
That's kind of what I did.
Years ago, Lisa Gardner told me that she does index cards along the floor, and she sees that she's got too much action. The color cards are red. And she sees she's got too much action at that point and she needs more green. So the green needs to go, or whatever it is, needs to go between, because you see you have a lull and you have to move the lull. So it was kind of interesting to do it in the different colors, you know?
Well, I use colors for characters.
Okay, got it.
So, you know, my main character is usually yellow, I got lots of those, but then I bring other ones in. But interestingly enough, she's right. And that's why we're talking about the stomach versus that's why the stomach didn't get thrown out. Because I had that lull, mm-hmm. and I needed to move things around. You know, I needed to make to fill in some gaps, because I didn't have a whole lot for summer.
Right.
I needed to fill in the summer.
Yeah, it's like, okay, what are we going to do like over here? You know, and I also felt that there was this talk about there's a difference between defending the woman and defending the truth. And it's very interesting how often you think that a lawyer is exactly doing that. It's like, they don't want to know the truth. Like, don't tell me if you're guilty or not. I don't really care. I've got to get up there and defend you and try to get you out of the situation. And I was surprised at how much was known about psychiatry back then, that it was more than I expected. Or did you, like, as you were meeting with psychiatrists, learn the same thing? Like, I did not know this was known.
So what I did is I found out, well, I know, so I have an aunt who suffers, or she's passed on now, but she suffered from schizophrenia, and she spent a number of years at the lunatic asylum in Stanton, this real place. And I knew that Powell was there. And so when I was researching the case, I found that he had defended them a number of times against people who were suing them or trying to get people out, or how they were treating a patient, et cetera. And so I found that the guy that had run that asylum from like 1840 or 50 or something up through 1874 was a guy named Dr. Francis Stribling, and that he had worked with Dorothy Dix, who was a big psychologist back of the war. I mean, she was pretty well known to come up with this moral medicine, the way to approach people who are insane. And he wrote a book, or there's a book written about him. I'm sorry, I have it in my authors, in my acknowledgments. And I read the book, and that's how I learned about the different melancholies, and I can't remember all the things I said in there, but you know, the different, you know, diseases as they, you know, obviously one is bipolar, you can definitely tell.
Right.
One's a bit of schizophrenia, one's just good old fashioned depression, you know, but anyway, a clinical depression. So, but they had different terms for them. And so I learned that from that book, and how he treated people at that particular asylum. You know, psychology really, and post-traumatic stress disorder really became a thing, although not that label, after the Civil War. You mm-hmm. were sending young boys, you know, 16, 17, 18 young men off into this horrible, horrible war. And you know, they came back really damaged. That's how St. Elizabeth's Hospital got established in Washington, D.C., to care for many of the insane that had suffered through that war. And it's not just men. I mean, women, and you know, there was a lot of women were raped. People were hiding. They were young women. They were hiding in these safe rooms when different groups of soldiers would come in. And I do believe that the North was more disciplined than the South, mm-hmm. At least in terms of the way the soldiers behaved towards the Confederates and other people. When I look back in history, you know, the Confederates were, and oftentimes a lot of rogue partisan groups mm-hmm. that would just go out and, you know, cause mayhem. And people suffered from that. And so there's a lot of writing about that post-traumatic stress disorder, but not under that word.
Right.
And that's where I sort of picked it up from, those writings, those letters, Dorothy Dix and Frank Stribling.
Do you love doing research?
Love it. I'm a data guy, gal. I just get in there. I mean, this is the problem when I'm writing. So I'm working on something now, and I needed to set in Baltimore. And I was about the gangs. And the next thing I know, I am like knee deep in gang research. It's not even going to make it into the book. It's just, you know, I need one line and I end up, you know, spending, you know, 4 hours, you know, down a rabbit hole. But sometimes it's worth it. Sometimes you find something really cool. You go, oh, I can use that. Right. Like, as I said, in one interview I did recently, when Powell was trying to get a hold of the cousin that was in Toronto, the whole Irish movement came up, and I'm like, the police, there was a real police department, and perhaps they were busy dealing with the resistance, the Fenian resistance that was going on at the time. And you know, they were trying to ransom Canada for Ireland with Great Britain. And so I used that, and I found that by going down one of my rabbit holes.
Right, right. And it also gives you that broader knowledge that you can just take to the page and make three sentences out of, because you just say, I see it now. I understand what people like, even the line back there about the difference between like the wars, the two wars, you'll only get that. And that's going to be like one paragraph, but it's going to come from a whole lot of reading, and you're going to distill it down to that. And you're going to say, oh, got it now. You know,
I read so much nonfiction, so many newspapers, Carol. Right. I mean, you know, I go into the newspapers and reading articles, because they're not indexed. You can't do a keyword search to find it. You got to just read them. They're on microfilm. Right. And the advertisements, you know, are always so fun, because you get a sense of what people were wearing.
Yes.
And what they were interested in, what they cared about. And that does sometimes make it in. It just gives you that sort of, you know, it's not that blurry background, right? It's just sort of, you sort of weave it into the story. And sometimes it's just one line or a couple words, but it, you know, it's something that I had stumbled across through doing all that reading and all that research.
Yeah, and it's really funny. I'll just equate it a little bit to modern times. When I was working at the magazine, all the models were models, like everyone, and now everyone's a celebrity. And you think about those times then, what defined beauty or what defined women, and what's defining women now. And it's celebrity versus somebody that you knew was just turning it on for the show, like turning it on for there. Very, very interesting, because when we sit and look at people, and that's not that long ago, you're talking about the 80s and 90s. You're not even talking that long ago in history, but the way we've embraced different things as time has gone on, what celebrity used to mean compared to now. And it's also, it's like what views are then compared to now, like what are, where's things coming to a head again? And they were quiet there for a while. If you look at the 90s, very different from now. Very, very different. And if you're going back and doing that same kind of reading, what would you be seeing? And it's, we can put it in our own terms to understand what you did as far as research is concerned. You know, life was different.
It was much, much different. And, you know, you can tell that from the advertisements. I mean, they're advertising fabrics. Oh, we just got a shipment of fabric in for dresses and hats.
Yes.
Right? Hats were really, really important. Men with boots. But, you know, they're advertising for seed that just came in, you know, it's just crazy kind of stuff.
We think like we're getting the fashions from Paris, or getting the fashions from this or that. And compared to today, it's completely different of what's going on. But you see where somebody would say, I have to have that fabric myself. You know, I'm also seeing there the arsenic being found in the wallpaper. I'm like, I had no idea. Now, I know you did a really big home renovation on Selma. I mean, did you like, this is where you learn some of these things?
Because some of it I did. Not that the wallpaper, I got, where did I get that from? I can't remember, but it's Shields Green. And it is this really electric, I know you've seen the color. It's this almost like, like a Zsa Zsa Gabor color, you know, it's just like, really bright greenish turquoise, just really, really bright, different than everything else. So the other papers will, the other colors would fade, but that Shields Green would stay there. At Selma, I will tell you that we have some of the stuff that we would have used, they'd used before, like some of the timber was soaked in arsenic, and it doesn't rot. Mm-hmm. You can't do that today. Because if it's on a playground, some kids use it, you know, or you know, it's in the air, it's in the ground, it's not good. But a lot of the wood back then, that's why when we were doing some of the bathroom remodeling, we would take boards and stuff down and reuse them, because they will never rot, because they've been soaked in arsenic. But the guys had to be really careful handling it. So
died at the house, you know,
not only that going on. But yeah, the Shields Green wallpaper was that color was laden with arsenic, laden with it. And it could dissipate in the air. I mean, I did read about that kind of stuff, how it could happen. But it wouldn't have ended up in her stomach unless she consumed it, unless she ate it.
Oh, she ate the wallpaper.
Some of my closing arguments.
Yeah, that's exactly.
Those are my closing arguments, by the way, just to let you know. You know,
there's somebody else's closing arguments, you know?
Okay.
It's interesting that I found this too, that people were going to testify later in the trial were allowed to sit in the room the whole time and hear what was going on, which was something I never know. And in your author's note, I saw a conversation about that. When did that change? That like now you can't be around, you know?
I would say probably, I don't know exactly, but I know some of the law got changed about 100 years ago in the teens and 20s. I don't know the history of it. I haven't read a book there yet, yeah. But the Virginia Code changed pretty significantly. But we still have crazy rules here in Virginia. So for example, there's no such law in the Virginia books for jury tampering.
Oh, really?
Yeah. You can get somebody for jury tampering in a federal case, but on a state case, there's no jury tampering rules, laws here. Crazy, right? I'm like, give me an enrichment. They need to redo some of these laws.
Let me go think about this, you know?
Yeah.
I also love that the government paid the trial costs when somebody was found not guilty.
I like that idea.
Yeah, I like that idea, but wow, I had no idea about that either. So if you know you're not guilty, okay, he's gonna be paid by the state.
If you're a prosecutor, you better be darn sure.
Right.
You know, because you're going to have to shell out the attorney's costs if you're prosecuting somebody who is, you know, you haven't got enough evidence to prosecute. Wow. So it does sort of take away some of these frivolous prosecutions. Mm-hmm. But it also requires the state's attorney to be on top of their game as well, you know. But I would think that, you know, that reverse could work too, is that, you know, you could seize the victims. I mean, the criminal at this point, the person that was indicted, the convicted individual, seize their assets to pay the state's costs if you lose, maybe. I don't know. Maybe it worked that way or not.
It could go the other way. It'd be interesting to know if it did, you know? Did you know how you're going to wrap the book when you began? Like, did you know?
Yes.
You did know, right? And you outlined or?
Well, when I first decided to start writing, I was, you know, didn't know if I was going to do this or not. And then a friend of mine, Anthony McCartan, who is a screenwriter, and he did Darkest Hour. He just did the Whitney Houston biopic, did Bohemian Rhapsody. He's a great screenwriter. He's got a book out now called Going Zero, bestsellers list. It's great. And he said to me, you must know your ending before you even start. Because if you're not writing to that ending, you're just going to ramble. So you have to know how the book's going to end. So I knew how the book was going to end. Of course, I also have the real history of the case. So I knew where the courtroom, where it came out from happening. But I had to put texture around that. You know, I didn't know what the verdict, I knew what the verdict was, but I had to also know what that meant to Powell. You know, was she innocent? Was she not innocent? Was she, you know, was she crazy? Was she not crazy? And so before I really started writing, I decided, based on my analysis of Emily Lloyd, I decided how that story was going to end. The question was, how do I get there and convince you as a reader that, you know, that it's believable and that I take you on that journey that, you know, you don't feel cheated at the end. Right. You feel satisfied that there was some justice in some way, even when in a world where there really wasn't a lot of justice.
Mm-hmm.
It still isn't in some cases.
Right. Who sees your work first when you finish it? Who do you pass it to first? Who do you pass your work to first when you finish?
My husband.
Your husband. Does he read every version or does he?
Oh, he reads all kinds of versions. I mean, I'll write a chapter and I'll say, does this sound right to you? And you got too much of this and all of that. So he does. And usually I have a development editor I work with, Deb Gitterman, who had really takes it from there and fixes all my English, but then really tells me, no, this is not working for me, or it isn't working for me. And the publisher now is, you know, my publisher's offering me to have that same sort of development edit to do it. But yes, the first version is usually my husband, and then it goes to a development editor I trust that has my voice, that understands, you know, where I want to go.
Which is critical.
And they really help me because they, you know, it's too long in the front, or you know, you're not developing this person enough. Or I had a hard time with Powell's arc in this book, how to tie it all up. And so there was a lot of attention paid onto that.
Yeah. You know, it's funny because I have one author that we interviewed, and the editor said, this book's really good. Start on page 150.
Oh, my goodness.
He said the beginning is you don't need it. You need starting here and go from here. And it's sometimes you've got to write your way in to what the story is. I mean, you know, Kristen Hannah is really clear that in Four Winds, she didn't find the character till later, because you're writing your way in and all of a sudden it's like, oh, wait, I see what I can do here. And I think that people think writing is writing. It's really rewriting and editing. Writing
the worst part.
writing is the easy part.
It's the easy part. Write down. Susan Meisner, I just talked to her recently on her book, Only the Beautiful, that just came out. She said that she rewrote it twice. So this is her third take. And at one point, she had the wrong protagonist. And then at another point, she had the wrong point of view.
Right.
Imagine having to change, you know, a whole book's point of view. I can't imagine.
Right.
It's a process. Thank goodness I got the protagonist right in this one.
Yeah. Because sometimes you're just not seeing it. And so-and-so needs to be bigger. I need this character bigger because we don't see him. We don't see him or understand him enough. But you don't know that on the first go through because
A lot of times on the first go through too, I find that some of the characters sound the same or are the same. Mm-hmm. So I had a hard time delineating between Janet's voice and Maggie's voice. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Took me a bit. And I found that Janet was pretty unlikable mm-hmm. in the beginning when I first wrote her. And I said, I can't have that because everybody's going to be upset that Pal is not with Maggie and instead with Janet. So I gotta fix her. That took me a while to figure out. Mm-hmm. And then I had a hard time between JW and Pal. Mm-hmm. I felt that I had them kind of written the same and they are not the same. So it took me, say like my last book, I had Jack and Armistead sometimes kind of confused. But as you said, these characters, they present themselves to you over time. Mm-hmm. And you do have to spend time revising and rewriting. To try to find their voice and find who they are and how they are and how they lived and how they work with each other and that mm-hmm. interaction, that dynamic. And like I said, I found it in Pal and JW, I found it an issue, and I found it definitely between Janet and Maggie.
Yeah, because at the beginning, Janet is angry and she can't be angry the whole book. If she's angry the whole book, there's not going to be a moment that you're going to feel that she's supporting her husband. You're not going to feel that at all.
You know, it's funny. My son, I have four boys, as you know, and my son, Zach, is in Florida and he's 24 and he finished the book just last night. He called me. I was at the film festival at a dinner and he calls me and he says, Mom, he says, oh my God. He's like, he was going off that. He loved it. But he said, I asked him who his favorite character was. And he said, Janet.
Mm, interesting.
And I said, that's interesting. Why? He goes, she's the perfect wife. He said, you know, she doesn't put up with any of his nonsense. She calls it and says it like it is. But when he makes a decision, whether she agrees or not, she's got his back. Wow. I thought, well, isn't that something? I didn't think of her as being the perfect wife at all.
Wow.
In the mouth of babes.
There's wisdom. There's wisdom there. Right. You know? That's what he's looking for. That's what he's looking for in a wife.
Well, she was pretty angry in the beginning.
She was. Yeah. She didn't want to be doing this at all. So,
well, you remember her son had just died not long before. Yeah. And I think she blamed her husband for her son's death. And so she was dealing with that. And, you know, she felt like, I think she was competing against between him and his career. Mm-hmm. You know, she was at odds with his career and his ambition. Mm-hmm. And that's why I wrote that part about when he was running for office. And, you know, Matt said, you know, well, you know, delivering on your wife's ambitions is an important thing to do. Where she was at odds with his ambition is what the issue was.
Right. With what he wanted to do. Was writing this book any easier than Mask of Honor, your first book?
Yes and no. Mask of Honor, I had no clue what I was doing when I started this. At least I have a process now. So I didn't spend a lot. I didn't write, you know, 260,000 words and had to come up with 106.
Right. Okay.
I wrote 100 and I think I had about 120,000 words and it came in just under 100 or 104 or something like that. So it was easier from a process perspective, but I had a harder time finding these characters than I did in Mask. I knew who Jack was. I knew who Lucinda. I mean, I just felt them, but I had a tougher time finding Pal. He's different than my classic guy. He's a quiet guy. He's reserved. Mm-hmm. At some point, I was afraid he was almost too perfect. So that's when I said, no, he's got to be, you know, he's got to have a temper. He's got to lose it with his kids. He's got to think about cheating. He's got to have some flaws. And so I had a hard time figuring out where that was. At one point I had him actually cheating. And then I said, no, if I have him cheating, then we all hate him. Right. That's not going to work. So I needed him to be sort of an Atticus Finch without all that perfection. He needed to have these flaws. But no, it was, I think getting those characters to have them present themselves to you was a more difficult process. And then the web was more difficult, you know, making sure that all the clues are there and making sure that those are written right and that pacing is right. This is more of a thriller, or you said a mystery.
It's like a mystery.
Than the other one. So that's harder for me. I've never done that before.
Yeah, Mask was historical fiction. This is a mystery, and a mystery's got to have a different buildup to it. It's got to have a different, there are different qualities that have to be, you know, is your next one a mystery? We're doing a mystery again?
Yes, it is. But you know, it's interesting, Carol. I just go where the story takes me. Mm-hmm. I mean, I find a story I think is really fascinating. And so then I just kind of let it take me where it takes me. So if it's a mystery, it's a mystery. The other one I think is probably going to be more of a thriller than a mystery. Mm-hmm. It's going to have more of the, you know, behind the scenes, who's done it kind of thing. We'll see where it goes. I mean, it's still in a work in progress.
It's an incubation.
But it's really where those characters lead you. Mm-hmm. I think that's what I'm writing. It's like a mirror. You're reflecting what you see in them. That's how I paint. You know, I just paint what I see. Mm-hmm. And that's what I write. I write what I see. I write what the research tells me. I write their story. And how that comes out is how it comes out. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. And I know you love to paint. Can you paint while you're writing, or are you?
I have to.
You do. Okay.
I have to, because I'll get a writer's block. I can't think of anything else. And I'll go to the studio and I'll slap some paint around. And the next thing you know, it's come to me. I figured it out. Or I'll go to the graves and sit and talk to them. They don't talk back, but I'll go to the graves and I'll sit and I'll talk to some of the characters and say, okay, you need to help me out here, pal. Dude, I'm having trouble today. But yeah, painting is a real release for me, creativity wise. Right. And then I also like to work on two books at once, so that like I'm researching a fourth book right now and putting some pieces and stuff around that while I'm writing this one, because it gives me some place to distract myself, you know, mm-hmm. otherwise mm-hmm. you get too wet and you can't see the forest and the trees. And then you come back and read what you wrote. And you go, okay, I know what's missing here.
Yeah. I can take these pages out, move this around, do this and mm-hmm. in a much better place. Was the title always Veil of Doubt?
No. Mm-mm. I had, you're gonna laugh. So when I was at this cemetery where the Lloyd children are buried, there are these lilacs that are blooming next to one of these grave sites. You know, they people plant stuff and they grow. And they were swaying back and forth. They were in bloom. It was like June. And I thought, ooh. Something with lilacs, and so among the lilacs or something like that. I was going down that thing, and then my husband's like, "That's awful. That's a horrible title."
Honestly,
yeah, so no, and I had a hard time with the title, but it just came to me one day. Yeah. I said, "That's it." When I was writing about her always wearing those veils and hiding those crazy eyes of hers, and then how the truth can be veiled, and that's sort of where I said truth can be veiled. I was like, veil of truth. No, I have a veil of doubt. I think you find yourself doubting through this entire book.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You doubt. I mean, it was interesting. I did a reading here, a couple passages on the night that it came out, the release night, not my big release party, but I did a reading there too, but some of my friends. And when I finished reading the first passage, they all said, oh, she's innocent. She didn't do it. Then I pick another passage and read, and they go, oh, she's guilty. She did it. So that's what I wanted. I wanted you to read through and say, okay, she did it. She didn't do it. She's crazy. She's not crazy. What's going on?
Yeah. No, it works out perfectly. And was the cover always the cover, or did you play around with that?
Because no, I had nothing to do with the cover other than pick it. So there were two covers. So the publisher, they're brilliant graphics people, mm-hmm. Came up with a couple designs. We narrowed it down to two. I liked the other one better at first. And then they went to the Ingram reps and presented it at a sales conference to all the reps at Ingram. And Ingram said this cover. They said they loved, they thought this was more modern. The other one had was like a ripped piece of paper and then just had the half of the woman's face and these really crazy green eyes and then a veil over. Mm-hmm. And they said that felt like a horror gothic novel. Mm. They didn't think it had the same resonance that this did. And so they did it and they picked it. And at first I was like, okay, reps, they know. And now I love it.
Yeah,
I really love the color scheme. I love, it really stands out and it's getting a lot of attention because of that cover, I think too.
And it's also, it just says a lot with her with the veil and the eyes and all that, just completely, you know, keep those hidden. What about the audio? You've got an audio.
Yes,
narrator.
It's released on Tuesday, 24th of October. So I don't know when this is going to be broadcast, but it's coming out. Yeah. And it may be out by the time you do this. And it's done by Gary Hoffman, who's a news is a radio personality in Los Angeles. Okay. And I listened to, they gave me probably 20 different voices. And I wanted somebody a little quicker because I didn't want it to drag. And I've listened to audiobooks where they just, that goes on and on. And I wanted someone who could really read and act Powell. I just loved his voice and I loved his pacing. So then I narrowed it down to like five, I think it was. And then they came back and did a longer reading and he was the guy. Yeah. And I'm going to Los Angeles on this weekend and I'm going to be meeting with him when we're out there. I think we're going to get coffee or something, but I love it. I love the audio. It's fast. And he does the closing arguments, Powell's closing argument, exactly as I envisioned it, exactly as I heard it in my head when I wrote it. I said to my husband, I said, he's so good. I mean, he just, you know, he's, well, he does this. And Scott said, well, you wrote it. And I said, this, yeah, I know that, but his delivery of it is like better than I even thought I could write it. It's yeah, fast.
I'm not going to deliver like that. Let me listen to him and maybe I'll get my delivery. You know, exactly. Go from there. So you're working on something new. You're working on two new things, which is great for, you know, readers. But you also do something really interesting because you've got your own book club and your book club has grown since the last time I talked to you. And I looked November 2nd, you're going to be reading Homecoming, which is one of my favorite books of the year by Kate Morton. It's long, but it's just fabulous. And when you're looking for a book, what are you looking for when you're looking for a book to read with your group?
I have some rules around it. First, it has to be historical fiction or at least in that genre in some capacity. It has to be set in a different time period. It can't be relevant time, current times. It has to be a current release in about a year, about 12 months. It's 13 because I can't get the author. It's fine, but I want it to be a current release. I want the author to have an opportunity to come in and to, you know, to speak if he or she is available and would like to join us. And that helps them promote their current work as well as something new that they're coming on, not something way back in the, from a long time ago. And then, I have to like it. I have to really enjoy it. I have to think it's got to be well written, well edited. And I have to feel satisfied at the ending. You know, I have to feel good about it. And I find that if I like it, that my group likes it. We have 1,500 right now and growing members, which is amazing to me. And we have anywhere between 25, like in August when everybody's on vacation, to, you know, 60 folks that come in, 65 on a Zoom call, and the author will come in most times and, you know, spend some time talking about their inspiration, and everybody gets a chance to ask a question if they'd like. And I make some observations and I talk about things that are really interesting in my mind, you know, foreshadowing and symbolism and some of the subtle messages that they were trying to deliver in the book. And it only lasts about an hour and then we do the next one. So I'm really looking for books that I think are just excellent reads that are well done. Some of them are by well-known artists, authors, and some of them more secure, obscure. Yeah. Like we did The Life of Sunflowers, I think it was called, by Marta Molnar last year. We're doing Loot by Tanya James in a few weeks, in a few months. So we're not necessarily Kristen Hannon or Barbara Kingsolver but we've done a lot of Amy Harmon. I love her work. We're going to be doing Mark Sullivan next year, his new book coming out.
Which is set in Uganda, I think is going to be so interesting.
Yeah.
So
interesting. Jiayin Chamberlain's. I ran into her at the grocery store down in North Carolina recently. We were chatting about what she's working on next. So people that I know that really do a great job of writing, but I want to read it in advance. To make sure that my readers are going to enjoy it. And they're very smart people. We have men and women in the book club. And they're all, you know, just bookworms like you and I, you know, like to read and like really good material.
And you want to see, like, is it going to be a discussable book? Because some books are really good, but you can't discuss them. It's not a topic that you'd be able to do that. And I think that's a big deal as well, to sit there and say, I can do that or I can't.
Sometimes I pick books that, you know, they are really well written, but they're going to be controversial. And I warn everybody up front, we all have opinions. It's about this book and the messages and how we feel about that. And they're a great bunch of folks that just, you know, really understand that. We've had some really interesting discussions and not everybody likes the books. You know, I picked Booth last year because I thought it was well written and I thought it was an interesting topic. And a lot of folks just didn't like it because it was you know, focused around, you know, John Wilkes Booth and his family. And, you know, and they felt that that, you know, was not a topic that they were going to get behind. I said, it's okay. It's about the writing. It's how she presented him that we were really focused on. I enjoy that. I love the discussions. I know you do the same thing in your book of Chino.
Yeah, yeah. And it's like, you really love to hear what people are coming back with, what they brought. Yesterday, we did our first Book Reporter Talks to Live with William Kent Kruger, and we gave nothing away. I just tried, we had 25 winners of this book, and they received it early. And we said, what are your thoughts on the books? We printed those. And then we said, what are your questions? And the questions were so good that I said, I'm going to their questions, not mine.
There
and
you
we
go.
Put some on screen. And it was really interesting to involve like a larger group of people. And we probably will do it like going forward, like, you know, with some of the interviews. If it's a book that's, and that's, you know, if it's a well-known author and the book's been out a little bit and people can actually talk about it, but with no spoilers. And that's a trick.
Yeah,
to
that's, so I have spoilers. So if you're going to go on my YouTube channel and watch them, you got to be careful, because if you haven't read it, you'll be spoiled. We do polls sometimes too. You know, what was your favorite character, or, you know, how satisfied were you with the ending? Or what if we had done this, that, and the other? And the author's there and can see this. Right. And they're really, they are surprised by some of the answers. They're like, I've never done a poll before at a book club. Yeah. But I think it's a fun way to sort of get engagement around a book, and about some of the topics and some of the decisions that the author made, excuse me, that I may have made differently.
Yeah.
Well, the I actually have asked questions. Yeah.
We did the Paper Palace, and at the end, I thought, who did she go with? Which one or this one? I did it with my book club, and I did it with online. And it is amazing the way people see the book completely differently. And that's the interesting part about book discussion, because there's nothing as personal as reading. Sports, you're usually watching it with somebody else, or there's enough fans that are relating in the stand or whatever. Go to a concert, there are enough other people. This is you and the book. That's it. And a lot of times, if you've read it in advance, no one has read it. So who are you going to talk to about it? So I'm always scrolling questions down, because I can talk to the author about it without giving anything away, but there's nobody really talk to about what's right. going on in the book. Right. And reading is the most private thing. So when you can go with a group, and sometimes we've had books that we didn't like in my book group, like my personal book group, but we had a great discussion, but we didn't like the book, or one person liked it, but we never put down the person who picked the book. Like, it's, we've all picked duds that somebody else didn't like. We've all done that, but nobody said, I'm the only one that picks the winners. You don't do it like that, but you do expand your reading. And sometimes we're reading something just because it's big, to just see what's everybody reading and why.
Right. Well, I did Lessons in Chemistry because I actually really loved the book. I loved it. It's one of those, I read it in a day.
Right.
Yeah, I just power read through stuff. And Susan Meisner's book, I read it in one sitting. It's a pretty big book. But a lot of folks didn't like it. I was surprised. Mm-hmm. And it was interesting to get their perspective as to why, right? And then even in my own book, I got a review recently, and someone made, I can't remember what the analysis they were, but they were looking at Emily, and they'd drawn some conclusion about her that they thought was really poignant. And I hadn't even thought of it, honestly. Yes. And I wrote her, you know, I was like, wow, that's brilliant. I didn't do it intentionally, but it's interesting how she came up with that sort of look at Emily in a way that a lens I hadn't seen her.
Yeah. And it's all of a sudden, oh, so that's how you saw her. Wait, now I'm sitting and having, and you see how you can have a really good discussion about a book. And
well, you know, what's interesting, Carol, too, is that, you know, because that comment was made about Emily, and some of the comments that I'm getting back on this book, it is helping me now with my next protagonist in terms of that's an interesting point. I hadn't thought of it. How do I incorporate that more into this new character? So the feedback is great for an author.
And you sit there and you also read what people are saying about reviews, like what they're saying, and you have some idea. And you do read the one, if you're going to read them, you got to read the ones and the fives, because you can't just read the fives, and you got to be the one and the twos. And the one and the twos, it may be the person's head at that time didn't want to read this kind of book. And you can see that as well. Right. Or wait a second, what are they saying? That's really good. Like that's a really, it's a clever reader. And a lot of people don't give books five. A great book, they're still giving a three. Mm-hmm. So they're still loving that book.
Right.
And I think these rating systems are like so tough, because most of the books, I can't sit there and say I could give a number to them. I could tell you why I loved it. And that's the reason I do bets on. Like I'm betting you're going to love it. And at the end of the year, I have to look at those books, and there's no set number I'm going to pick. And I have to say those books hold up. Either that, or why did I pick that?
Exactly.
And there's some I think about during the year and I put them up like in my mind with the others. And I go, it doesn't hold up. It's not part of the story. Even though I liked it, it's not going to resonate the same way.
Right. It's tough. And, I wish that sometimes I could get into a dialogue with some of the folks in terms of, tell me why it struck you this way. And you just can't do that, obviously, because I'm learning, as I go, what appeals to people. Some people thought it was really fast paced. Someone says a slow start. I was like, I got a death in the first chapter. I'm not quite sure. Murder, suicide, all kinds of stuff. I don't know what else they're expecting. The biggest challenge with my writing so far, the two I've published, has been genre. Mm-hmm. Mask of Honor, was it romance? Was it political fiction? Was it just historical fiction? What is it? This book, we talked about this earlier, mystery, thriller, legal, procedural, what is it?
Historical, looking at, it's so many different things. And books being pigeonholed is hard because somebody will say, oh, I don't read historical mystery, or I don't read this, that, the other thing, but then you miss out on a good book. And it's hard too, because there's so many books out right now. I mean, everything gets sent to my house and I still can't keep up. I mean, it's not like I have to go anyplace. They're here. And I have these piles. Like when I was on vacation this summer, I read a book a day for 8 days because I had to catch up because I was so stressed that I was behind. I was so stressed of these are all coming out. They're all really good. And I want to make sure that we're covering them the way I want to cover them. And there's still things in the other room that have to be read that I want to do interviews. And I'm like, it's not going to be as timely as I planned, but that's the way it was going.
And I like sometimes these obscure authors like myself, mm-hmm. who's not a Kristen Hannon yet.
Mm-hmm. not also named yet, but by the same token, it's
to help them.
It's sitting there looking at their, by you doing the book club and listening to people giving you the feedback on other books, it improves your writing as well, because you're not writing you're not writing in your own mind. You're writing like, oh, what do you think? Blah, blah, blah. And I think it's fascinating to see how you've built the book club, because I remember when we talked, it was a couple of years ago, and you had 50, 60 people of what was going on, or 100 people. And now the way it's grown, and to see people just following.
It's a project among itself. It's, mm-hmm. it's a really big deal. And what it's done, like you said, it's helped my writing. It's also helped me develop an audience. Mm-hmm. It's really just, it's been fabulous. And I don't know if any other authors are doing it. Mm-hmm. And I get an opportunity to meet other authors I would never meet. When I mm-hmm. first started writing, you need to get endorsements, they said, for your book from another author. I'm like, I don't know any authors,
Right.
But this has really helped me develop relations with some of them and learn that from their writing and seeing what really works well, what doesn't work so well. And then the feedback, I love it. It's a different approach. So I got my book club, which is growing. And then I have my following for my writing, mm-hmm. And then all the marketing promoting you got to do when a book comes out does interfere with your ability to write.
But what's interesting too, if you can't get an author to come to an event, you may sit there and say afterwards, will you answer 3 questions that came up during the conversation? Mm-hmm. And then instead do that and say, if I send you 3 questions, and then you could send them out to the people that were there so that they're getting the author's feedback and share what happened at the meeting and stuff like that. That may be something good, because you can't get all the authors all the time. A lot of them are, it's a time zone thing. There's a big time zone question. The other question is, are they working on something else or promoting something else at the time that they're too far entrenched? Or they have talked about this book so much, they want to wait for another format to come out to go out and do it again,
And there's that.
There's also the times where authors who have speaking agents are being paid to go out to do these things at a certain point. And you just have to sit there and judge it at the right moment, or they just can't talk about the book anymore.
Right.
And I've heard that. It's like, I just can't do this anymore. I have to go do something else.
And sometimes, my team, my folks in my book club will say, gee, can we just... have the author on for half hour, 40 minutes, and then have 20 minutes to ourselves to basically and talk about it without the author there.
Right.
So I've been trying to do that. So it cuts down the obligation, the time that the actual author has to be on the phone with us, which is, I think, maybe helpful as well.
Yeah. And the author sometimes wants to be on Zoom so they can show you things or do things like that. And the other thing is, the author like calling in, sometimes it's good if you do your 20 minutes up front so you formulate what your questions are going to be, so that when the author comes on, you've already discussed the book, and then you flip to the author coming on, we've got a couple of questions for you, and you go boom, 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 and then because usually if they want to stay 15, 20 minutes, that's like, you know, I consider it a gift. And some have stayed longer with my book club because they've really got entrenched in talking to us, but it's, you don't want the obligation to have to be that much.
Yeah. You know, I've, since I ran a company for a long time, I'm pretty punctual when it comes to my meetings. If I say it's an hour, it's an hour. And then, you know, I work my schedule that way. So I think my folks do like that sort of just 1 hour, because they can also plan their day and their evening.
Right.
You know, we start at 7, we're done at 8. And right. If it goes to 8:01, I'm like, okay, ladies or guys, whoever, we got to roll on.
But
it's been probably one of the most rewarding and satisfying things about writing is being able to have a regular audience mm-hmm. of people who love historical fiction. And, you know, those are my readers. Mm-hmm. And so when I put a beta version out, I can pick a few folks when I need some early reviews before it's been released. Those are some of my folks to get feedback on. I have done... I think it was on this particular book, Unveil, I sent it out maybe a year and a half ago and got feedback because mm-hmm. I was getting some pushback from, you know, publishers about some of the things in here. And I said, they didn't like it. And I said, no, I've got a reader base. I sent it out to 10 of them and they love it. Their feedback was this, that, and the other. So, you know, getting some of that to help you hone your arguments when you're mm-hmm. selling a book. The good mm-hmm. news, I haven't got to sell a book now. My publisher's going to take my next one and the next one, so I'm fine. But
yeah, you're fine.
That's a tough process, you know, in general. Yes.
Well, it's finding an agent, finding the publisher, deciding you love working with the publisher and you want to go on and do something else. And people don't understand the business of publishing besides writing. There's a business of publishing, and there's a totally different thing. And a lot of people go in and not understand the business side of what happens. And the sales team making a decision about a cover, not you. Like, just because they're going to go, or a title, like, this title's not going to work.
Right.
And I was talking to an author a couple of weeks ago, and he said that they just said this title's wrong. Like, this is what we're going to change it to. And it was interesting because it's, and you're like, okay, now I get it. I see it. But you've been in the zone. Well, I'm like looking forward to the next book. I'm telling you, because I just enjoyed your work so much. And it was somebody, look, guys, we're going to say you weren't the biggest author when I read your first book, and it's picking up the second book. It's like, okay, what's going to happen? And I really, really enjoyed it once again. So two best.
I thought you would like it. I mean, you never know. It's a different book. I mean, mm-hmm. Mask of Honor was definitely a different sort of genre, if you will, within the historical fiction world. But this one, I just fell in love with Pal Harrison, his character, mm-hmm. I love the JW and Matthew sort of comic relief in between to lighten it. It's a dark book, mm-hmm. but you have to have some of that lifting, you know, the old Alfred Hitchcock. You can't keep people up here all the time. You got to let them rest, have a few laughs. And I just love it when people like you, you know, pick up a book like this and say, you know, I'm going to take a chance and read it, and then fall in love with it and say, yes,
Lara,
I'm betting on it.
Lara and Lilith and our reviewer. I mean, Amy was loving the book. And it's like when you hit that sweet spot where, okay, everybody's clicking on the book, it makes such a big difference. Because it's building a following. Nobody starts out with a huge following. I mean, it's John Grisham was selling books out of the trunk of his car. The movie was being made before the book came out. There was another book before that became a bigger book later. I mean,
his story is fabulous. I love his story.
It's all history. It's all happened in an instant over 10 years. You know what I mean?
Exactly. Yeah. It takes a long time to get there. Well, I will tell you the good news about this book is I think we told you we've been hitting some pretty high numbers on Amazon's new release number 2 last week. And we've already exceeded our publishers. You know, they put together a forecast of 90 days of how much they're going to sell. And we've already 50, 60%, 70% over in some in paperback, I think, and hardcover, we're almost out. They're going to do another print run because it's selling so quickly.
Did the hardcover go to the libraries mostly? Is that what the
libraries? But a lot of, it's on Amazon. A lot of people are buying it.
Hardcover, yep.
On Amazon. I was shocked. Yeah. I think, you know, how many people are, when I had my book signing here, most of the folks that showed up with it had hardcovers.
Right.
I was shocked by, but yeah, it's, libraries are picking them up and,
then you got to combine those two numbers for what the real sales actually are, because then that's what becomes really interesting is what are people looking for? Is there another chance for it in paper? even though it's already in paper because so many people are reading it in hardcover. And a lot
of I haven't seen any ebook sales yet. I don't know what those are. It's now, the first week.
Ebook and audio. And you know, it's interesting. Ebook sales this year, they say are a little bit down from before. So we'll see what happens with that. Audio's up. And audios were so much come into its own in these last couple of years. It used to be like your rights were like your rights to Finland. Like it was like not really big. Now I have to sit there and say to people, you know, the audio rights are going to be really important on your book. You know, really got to pay attention to this. So
yeah, I'm love it. I love this audio. Like I said, I get chills. It feels like a different book when I read it or I listen to it. Mm-hmm. We were at the pool listening to, you know, all the samples, the draft or the beta, mm-hmm. The alpha, whatever you get in that you have to listen to make sure he's pronounced the words right and all that stuff. And my husband and I had it on the speaker listening right? to it. You know, it was so good.
That's like a party.
If you love the, if you like the book itself, you really want to listen to the audio because it's almost, he acts it. Mm-hmm. He's like an actor. Mm-hmm. He really does a great job.
You'll have fun meeting him this weekend.
Yeah, I will.
So as always, it's great. It's always great to talk to you. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you all for believing in this book and my writing and for all the attention you've given it. Because, you know, when you're writing them and it's a different genre than what you did before, you're taking a chance there, you know, yeah. and especially when people are pushing back, publishers and some agents, et cetera. The belief in the book and the belief in what I've been doing it's just been phenomenal. I just can't thank you guys enough.
So much fun. So next time, look forward to seeing you next time on Book yes. Reporter Talks too. And to everybody else, you can find us on YouTube, remember on the Book Report Network or podcasts, wherever you listen to Book Reporter Talks too. And thanks so much for joining us today. Keep listening for an audio excerpt from Veil of Doubt by Sharon Virts, narrated by Gary Hoffman, coming up after the credits. Courtesy of Girl Friday Audio. Thank you for listening to Book Reporter Talks 2. Don't forget to subscribe so you never miss an episode. Support us by sharing on social media or by telling a friend about us. And we look forward to next time on Book Reporter Talks 2. This show has been produced by Jordan Red Productions. And now, hear an audiobook excerpt from Veil of Doubt, narrated by Gary Hoffman, courtesy of Girl Friday Audio.
Sky-splitting thunder cracked like canisters firing from 12-pound cannons as drenching rain cascaded in blinding sheets onto two physicians picking their way through muddied Virginia clay to the front stoop of a modest home on Loudoun Street. When they stepped onto the porch, a young woman with tawny skin and warm, tired-looking eyes, glassy and red, opened the door. "She's upstairs," said the maid, Delphi Lossenberg, as she threw open the door and invited them inside. The house was stale with sickness. The sour smell of vomit and lye intermingled with the sweetness of damp ash from a dwindling fire. Wind gusts howled overhead and rumbled down the chimney, sparking embers to glow and crackle. Delphi took their coats and hats and brought them up the narrow stairs that led to the child's room. Not 12 hours ago, when Dr. Randolph Randy Moore had walked into the small room at the top of the stairs, little Maud Lloyd had been sitting up against the headboard, playing with a new bisque doll that, she had explained, was her birthday present. Her blue eyes had been alert, and she told him that both her tummy and her dolly were feeling much better. Though she was pale and weakened from nearly 3 days of purging, he'd been confident that she would recover. The porcelain doll now lay near the foot of the bed, its fair hair disheveled and its wide eyes cast vacantly at the ceiling. Like the doll, Maud's flaxen hair was tangled. Her eyes were half open, staring upward. He was having trouble believing this to be the same child. Her skin was pallid, the lids of her eyes dark and sunk deep in their sockets. She gasped for air between parted, pasty lips, just like her older sister, Annie, who had died the month before. Dread washed over him.